Hello, my name's Florence. Welcome to the Obs Pod. I'm an NHS obstetrician, hoping to share some thoughts and experiences about my working life. Perhaps you enjoy Call the Midwife, maybe birth fascinates you, or you're simply curious about what exactly an obstetrician is. You might be pregnant and preparing for birth. Perhaps you work in maternity and want to know what makes your obstetric colleagues tick, or you want some fresh ideas and inspiration. Whichever of these is the case, and for that matter, anyone else that's interested, the Obs Pod is for you. Episode 137, Infant Feeding, a chat with Lindsay Hookway. Today, we're going to talk all about infant feeding, and to help me with that topic, because I have a depth of ignorance that we're going to explore, I have fantastic Lindsay Hookway. Lindsay, welcome to the Obs Pod. Perhaps you would like to start by telling people a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. Thank you very much for having me, first of all. So my background is in paediatric nursing and children's public health nursing, aka health visiting. But I'm also an IBCLC, International Board Certified Lactation Consultant. And these days, to be honest, most of my time is spent doing my research. I'm researching the needs of breastfed medically complex children in paediatrics. And I also curate a fairly chunky Instagram page that actually takes a remarkable amount of my time alongside juggling my kiddies, which is how we first met. We established, you actually cared for me with my second little one, who made a slightly less lovely, soothing entrance into the world 10 years ago.
Yes. And I did spend a bit of time thinking, is this the same Lindsay Hookway that I know, before reaching out to you? And so it was really lovely. And it is great to actually catch up with you all these years later and hear a bit about your family and the baby that is no longer a baby and is living a fantastic 10-year-old life.
Absolutely. Yeah. 10 is a great age, I've decided. To be fair, she's had quite a life with battling sepsis and cancer and all sorts of stuff. But actually, she's having a great time. So it's, I'm quite envious, actually. Go back in time and do it all over again.
Yes. So you mentioned then IBCLC. And the first thing I think I thought about when I thought about us discussing infant feeding is I have this kind of generalized awareness that everyone's working towards baby friendly and the UNICEF baby friendly sort of accreditation. And I know that was in the NHS long-term plan, but I must admit, when all these kind of different letters get trotted out and different areas of expertise get discussed, I'm a little bit at sea. So I wondered if you could start by explaining a bit about kind of what's going on in infant feeding with all these different letters and levels of accreditation.
Yes. Yeah. You're not alone. I think most of us feel pretty confused by the alphabet soup that is out there. We've got peer supporters, breastfeeding counsellors, mother supporters, IBCLCs, lactation consultants, lactation specialists. The truth is, you can call yourself whatever you like. So the only title that is protected is International Board Certified Lactation Consultant, which doesn't really roll off the tongue anyway. So starting from healthcare professionals and moving outwards then, as part of my research, actually, I kind of dug into the scope of training and educational competencies of lots of different healthcare professionals. And paediatric nurses don't have any core mandatory undergraduate breastfeeding training. That's kind of mind-blowing, isn't it? In fact, I checked. Yeah, can you believe that? So as a paediatric nurse, infant oral feeding is not on the educational competencies. You have to be competent at NG feeding and other enteral feeding, but not oral feeding, believe it or not.
Yeah. Wow. That is mind-blowing. Because I checked our curriculum for obstetricians because I remember having zero training.
Yes.
And I thought, well, I'll just check because they've done a whole new curriculum just a couple of years ago. It'll be up to date, won't it?
Nope.
And literally, I was looking last night. It's not there at all.
Nope.
No mention of infant feeding at all.
No. Nope.
I thought that was bad for obstetricians, but for paediatric nurses,
that's
absolutely astonishing.
It is astonishing. So it's also not a core competency for paediatric doctors, for paediatric trainees. It's not on the RCPCH curriculum. It's not on the curriculum for GPs. So there's some broad mentions of public health, but I mean, you'd have to be quite intentional about getting breastfeeding in to interpret public health as incorporating breastfeeding. And then it's also not a core competency for speech and language therapists, dietitians, believe it or not. So it's quite astonishing, really, how little breastfeeding training is actually mandatory for healthcare professionals. The only healthcare professionals who have embedded breastfeeding training as part of their core undergraduate training are midwives. And then other organisations who are sort of working towards baby-friendly accreditation include health visitors. So some universities who are baby-friendly accredited are training health visitors as part of their health visitor training. And then also neonatal staff. But neonates is a very separate department to paediatrics and maternity. Of course, there's crossover and there's links, but actually they are organizationally separate.
Right.
So that's where we are in terms of healthcare professionals. So if a mother or lactating parent needs breastfeeding support, hopefully their midwife has had some breastfeeding training. They may have had some additional breastfeeding training if they're in a BFI accredited maternity unit as well. But beyond that, they're going to be looking to their health visitor when they're discharged by their midwife into the care of the health visiting team in the community. Some communities have infant feeding clinics that might be run by health visitors, nursery nurses. Again, this is not standardized, so there's a little bit of a postcode lottery still here. And then beyond that, we're sort of looking at the fact that breastfeeding support services are propped up by the third sector, so voluntary sectors.
So I'm just thinking, so midwives, they will see women on the postnatal ward, and then they'll do some visits in the community, maybe up to 28 days if that person's having some enhanced postnatal visits.
Yeah.
But for most people, it'll be up to 10 days. And if they're the only definitely trained health professionals, well, then your breastfeeding would fall off a cliff immediately, wouldn't it? Because you might start by 10 days, you've barely got established because your milk's only going to come in day 3 or 4. And then you've got probably someone with no experience or maybe a bit of experience if you're lucky. And yet breastfeeding rates are one of the key things that the NHS loves to count and report.
Well, they do and they don't, because of course the infant feeding survey was disbanded many, many years ago. So although this is a really good measure of one of the core public health outcomes, there hasn't been that investment in monitoring and improving. And meanwhile, of course, lots of services have been cut. Lots of the wonderful support clinics that were, again, as I said, propped up by the third sector. So it might have been run by breastfeeding counsellors and peer supporters who were funded by local authorities. A lot of those services, unfortunately, have been cut. And, you know, people get creative, especially people who are passionate and want to help other people. You know, services move online. People are altruistic. They start setting things up out of the goodness of their hearts. But there's a lot of goodwill out there that's not perhaps being matched by a sort of, you know, investment in healthcare.
Well, also, it's not only not matched by investment, we put impossible hoops for people to jump through. Within my family, my sister-in-law she thought after she breastfed her three children and she wasn't working, I'll be a peer supporter, I'll give something back. And the amount of training she had to do and the checks she had to go through and the hoops that they made her do before she actually was able to do anything, she did end up doing it for maybe a couple of years, but she could have done maybe 4 or 5 years, but it took so long to actually achieve it. And then she went back to work and, you know, can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
They made it almost impossible for her to give back.
I know. It's really difficult for volunteers to support the NHS. That particular link is really, really difficult. So getting peer supporters onto the postnatal ward, for example, is extraordinarily difficult. And, you know, for some good reasons, like safeguarding, and we've managed the risk of all of that. But yes, I agree. We do create these ridiculous obstacles for people who are just trying to prop the system up. So peer supporters generally have about 12 weeks of training. Breastfeeding counsellors usually study sort of part-time over about 2 years. And then IBCLCs, there's no set training, but you have to study against the blueprint for the exam. So you have to have demonstrable evidence of having studied. So you need 95 hours of education that are lactation-specific hours. And then you also need 1,000 hours of documented breastfeeding counselling. In fact, when I did my IBCLC, it was 2,000. They've halved it.
That's a lot of hours.
It's a lot, yeah. And it's really difficult to get those hours if you're not a health professional, because you would potentially need to work as a peer supporter or a breastfeeding counsellor, again, with the expectation that you're giving your time for free. Don't get me started on the, yes, you know, the feminist kind of argument for that, and, you know, not valuing the skilled work of women giving their time for free. Probably need to step away from that soapbox. But essentially what happens is that you actually end up excluding a lot of people who would be wonderful at supporting other families to make informed infant feeding decisions, because essentially this becomes a sort of a position of privilege, because you have to have the means to work voluntarily. You have to have the means to study, to do the courses, to do the training, to sit the exam itself is hundreds of pounds as well. So the whole system is a little bit broken. So it never really surprises me when people don't manage to meet their breastfeeding goals. It saddens me, because a lot of women, as Professor Amy Brown has found, are carrying the sadness of that for many years. This is not about breastfeeding professionals wanting to push other people to breastfeed. It's about enabling people who do want to breastfeed to meet those self-defined goals, whatever they might be, 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, 5 years, whatever. Yes. So it's about how society is putting in place all of these bonkers barriers that make just the simple act of meeting your own self-defined breastfeeding goals almost unachievable unless you're really tenacious and persistent.
Yeah, I think you're so right, because so my breastfeeding experience comes from breastfeeding my two children.
Yeah.
That's it. And I was very lucky. I had very poor birth experience, which I've talked about openly, but I did manage to breastfeed my children. And that, for me, was actually psychologically quite a redeeming feature.
Yes.
That I felt like, actually, I can do this. I got this bit of being a mother right.
Very
and that
healing.
Makes me feel less of a failure about all the bits that didn't go right.
Yeah.
But I remember, I mean, my kids are in their 20s now, but I remember in my antenatal group and my group of friends that were having babies at the same time, everyone wanted to breastfeed. But only a couple of us actually ended up breastfeeding successfully for a longer time.
Yes.
People fell by the wayside. And it was that kind of programming of breast is best. So the incredible guilt also when people didn't meet, like you say, their breastfeeding goals. It wasn't that they were like, oh, well, I'm going to give formula. I remember my husband saying to one of them, you know, actually, it's not like they're suddenly going to grow up with some massive physical problem because they weren't breastfed. It's not like you're damaging your child by not achieving breastfeeding, but they were devastated.
Yes.
So I think you're right. We're not giving people the right support. We're telling them they should do this because there's all these health benefits, and then we're not giving them the support, and then they feel a failure and distress because they can't manage it. Because we've set them up to fail almost.
Absolutely. And I always kind of see in my mind the picture of, you know, the mother sitting in a clinic underneath the poster of why you should breastfeed, and yet everybody she reaches out to saying, oh, I'm really sorry, I don't know. Maybe you should just give a bottle. Oh, I don't know, maybe like, you know, 150 mils per kilo or whatever. You know, there's lots of hitting brick walls when you reach out, and part of that is because there just isn't enough training in the people who most women access for breastfeeding support. Not everybody has the means to get transport to the nearest breastfeeding clinic, and of course, because so many of them have been shut down, you might have to travel quite far. There might not be a bus. There might not be a clinic run by somebody who speaks your language. You might then be thinking, oh gosh, I'm going to have to get an IBCLC because no one knows the answer to this really quite complicated, nuanced problem. Yeah. But actually, the IBCLCs, that they're not always employed in an NHS setting. Sometimes they work privately. Not everybody can afford that. So again, that there are multiple barriers that we put up. And it's really sad because, as I said, it's not about making people who are ambivalent or antagonistic about breastfeeding breastfeed. It's about supporting people who genuinely want to. The training is just, it's not in depth enough. It doesn't equip the people like midwives and health visitors and doctors to be able to answer the kinds of questions that crop up. And that's part of my work in pediatrics, because a lot of the training and information and education that is available is weighted towards the initiation of breastfeeding in, you know, the first, you know, few hours of life and the first few days worth of problems, and overcoming and troubleshooting those common issues that crop up in the first, you know, few weeks. But actually, there's very little information about overcoming some of the barriers later down the line in a wider age range, which is problematic because, of course, that sort of means that if you get to 3 months and you're experiencing a problem with breastfeeding, or your little one is ill or whatever, you know, sometimes these problems can feel insurmountable at that point because nobody has the answer to your problem.
Yeah. And so I read one of your blogs about specialist infant feeding teams.
Yes.
And you mentioned in that blog sort of different levels of support that people might need. And that kind of made a lot of sense to me, that there's kind of not a hierarchy, but a kind of escalation.
Yeah, like triaging. So,
exactly. Yeah. And I kind of think sometimes, so we have a great infant feeding team at work, but I worry sometimes when things escalate to them that it's a little bit passing the buck, you know. So if we center the expertise in a group of midwives or support workers who are particularly interested in infant feeding, do we then de-skill the other midwives, or is it okay because actually they're just giving a different level of support for the more complicated problems?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think there is a danger that we de-skill the majority by having all of that expertise within a minority. It's also quite a lonely place to be if you are in that infant feeding team, because you can feel like a sort of lone advocate amidst a sea of, oh, I don't know, kind of attitudes, which has been reported many times in the literature. That's not me just making that up, by the way. There's a lot of evidence that people defer to their own experience, and therefore what the risk with that is that that is dependent on whether that experience was positive, negative, mixed. You know, we can only speak to our own experience. And that, of course, is, you know, biased and has inherent problems with it. I think the other problem with sort of putting all of the expertise among a small group of people is that you can end up with almost like they are then the only people who can deal with anything. So even the simple problems need to go to the infant feeding team, when actually everybody should have a reasonable level of baseline knowledge. Everybody should be able to support a mother with pain-free attachment of her infant at the breast. Everybody should be able to answer questions about responsive feeding. Everybody should be able to, you know, answer some of the common things that come up in the first few days of life. That those things shouldn't all have to go to the infant feeding team. The infant feeding team should be there to deal with, I've got this baby, there's something not quite right with the feeding. We've tried skin to skin, we've tried letting the little one self-attach, and we've had a hands-off approach, and we've done all these things, and we've tried some hand expressing, and we've given the baby some buccal colostrum, and you know, we've tried all of that. And now what? That's where the infant feeding team should step in, not to go, well, have you tried some skin to skin? You know, they shouldn't be coming in with the basics. And I think that is the risk when we put all of the skills into 5 or 6 enthusiastic, passionate and well-trained people.
So you touched on skin to skin there. And so I suppose as an obstetrician, I feel I've got a major role to play in that. So I annoy people a bit by going straight for skin to skin at cesarean, for example, when I can. And some of my midwifery and anaesthetic colleagues tolerate it, and some of them are a bit like, oh, it makes a terrible mess, blah, 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 blah. But I see that I've got a definite role there. I find it more difficult on the postnatal ward. So this kind of silo approach of now, so your whole pregnancy, I've looked after you and your baby, but now you're separate beings. Yes. There are these other people, paediatricians, neonatologists and neonatal nurses, they look after your baby and I just look after you. And I'll go round, and when I've seen anyone or examined them or done anything, I always say, have you got any other questions? And I'd say maybe 75% of the time, they then spark up with a question about their baby. And then I'm left going, I don't know, I'm not the right person. I've got to ask the midwife or the paediatrician or whatever. So what if perhaps some obstetric doctors or newly qualified midwives are listening to this, what are the kind of basic things that they can contribute, or what is a good place if they want to understand a bit more what their role is within infant feeding, that they could go and do a bit of thinking? Because like you say, we haven't got it in our curriculum, but we have got health promotion and we have got public health. So actually educating ourselves a bit and what our role is within this would be good.
Yeah, absolutely. I think obstetrics is a really unique specialty like that, isn't it? I don't know of any other specialty where that would be an issue. As you say, that you've looked after the dyad that can't be separated for months. Yes. And then all of a sudden, you're only able to answer questions about one bit of the dyad, which is odd, isn't it? And it's a little different for midwives. But you're right, there's a sort of a disconnect there, isn't there? And then you rightly point out that the baby would be up to the neonatologists, unless the baby goes home and is readmitted, and then it's the paediatrician. It's all very confusing, isn't it? Yeah. And of course, all neonatologists have a background in paediatrics in the first place and subspecialized, but the neonatologists don't have any infant feeding training either. So it's mind-blowing. I think, honestly, one of the things that everybody can do when you're caring for women postnatally on the ward is be encouraging, to not discourage breastfeeding or responsive feeding or responding frequently to early cues, to reassure them that yes, if they pick their baby up every single time their baby squeaks and feed them, that's a brilliant idea. There's literally nothing bad that's going to happen if you do that. If you want to keep your baby in constant skin-to-skin contact for the first month of life, 2 months of life, fantastic, crack on, just do it. There's literally no downside. There's no side effect that we need to worry about with that. So I think there are some really straightforward things. We don't want to be telling people about routines or amount of time on each breast, or we want to steer clear of stuff that is myth-based and speculation. And the trouble with that is, to understand that something is a myth, like, for example, the myth about foremilk and hindmilk, then you have to understand the fact in the first place. Otherwise, you can't identify it as a myth. So if you want that kind of information, you're probably going to need to do a little bit more learning. And there are lots of places you can do that. There's the BFI e-learning. That's a good place to go. There's also the ABM. They've got a really short course. There's a course for partners and grandparents. And again, that's really accessible. I can get you the link and you can add it to the show notes. Yeah, but there are some free and accessible ways of getting bite-sized piece of information. There's things like Global Health Media that have lots of videos that demonstrate early latching and things like that. So there are, I think part of it is, you know, being encouraging, being kind, not reverting to, you know, perhaps speculative information. And then also knowing when you don't know. I think that's a really, really important thing. There is literally no harm in saying, oh gosh, you know, I don't have a clue. But this is a great website. You know, you could go to the La Leche League website. There's loads of information on the La Leche League website. You could go to the Kelly Mom website. You could go to the Breastfeeding Network website. If you've got questions about drugs in and medications in breastfeeding and their compatibility, you can go to the Breastfeeding Network, and they've got a whole section on drugs in breastfeeding. There's so many resources out there. But of course, you've got to know that they exist in order to signpost to them in the first place. So I'll send you all the links and you can...
That'd be fantastic. I'm interested that you just mentioned a course for partners and grandparents and so on, because actually last week I recorded an episode with Terry Gavin Jones, which is about cultural curiosity, and she's got a grandmother's group because of that knowledge coming down from the older women in some communities to the younger women. And I think that's something definitely that was missing for me, that my mother and my generation, most of our mothers bottle fed. Yeah. And therefore, there was no intergenerational grandparent advice and support or knowledge. Yes. And so that idea of something that other members of the family can do to support someone who's trying to feed, that's such a brilliant, simple thing.
It is, because, of course, we are social beings. There's this incredible story that goes round and round the internet from time to time about a gorilla that got pregnant in San Diego Zoo. And the first time she became pregnant and had her baby, she didn't know what to do with her infant. She'd been raised in captivity and she'd never seen a primate infant being breastfed before. And unfortunately, the baby died. She became pregnant again. And this time, during her pregnancy, they got the local La Leche League to come and have a nurse off outside the enclosure. And second time around, baby was born and she breastfed. We are social beings. We learn about how to care and nurture our little ones from not only reading about it and being told by someone, but also by observation. And I think it's all very well to say that it's instinctive and natural. Well, yes, it is, but it's also social, and it's a learned behavior. And in the same way that, you know, learning to walk or learning to drive a car, you know, some elements of some of the things that we develop abilities with have bits of instinctual behavior in them, but they're still learned skills. And I think when we've lost that intergenerational knowledge and expertise, that's a real missing link in that social competence. And in cultures where there is that long-standing intergenerational support, you see higher rates of breastfeeding. And this is borne out when we look at breastfeeding rates of people of different ethnicities in this country. Within a couple of generations, what you actually see is that people who are Black and of other ethnicities other than white, they start off having higher breastfeeding rates, but within a couple of generations, they're actually modifying their behavior to match the local behavior of the community. So again, that's about that loss of community and loss of social behavior that is common among a different culture and community. So it's a really, really complex issue. And I think one of the ways to address it is by looking at some of those influencing factors on our behavior and our decision making and our self-efficacy, which obviously comes from peers, comes from parents. I was breastfed. My mother was a hippie rebel in the early 80s, and most of her friends didn't breastfeed, but actually my mum did. They kind of bucked the trend, and so breastfeeding was something that she didn't talk about it, but she was supportive, and she was supportive of responsive parenting and bed sharing and all sorts of parenting behaviors that facilitate breastfeeding. And so without knowing it, without actually talking to me about breastfeeding, she was supporting my decision to breastfeed by not saying, oh, you got to let that baby cry, or you got to get that baby on a 4-hourly routine, Lynn. She's going to have you wrapped around her little finger in 2 seconds. And of course, all of those elements impact on our ability to be able to breastfeed successfully as well. So yeah, it's really complicated. And that's how I got into sleep, actually. I got into sleep work via breastfeeding. I kept on noticing it again and again and again that babies being babies and babies waking up in the night and behaving completely normally ended up being a barrier to breastfeeding. And I refer to breastfeeding being a sleep scapegoat quite a lot, because a lot of times people are blaming something that is just normal behavior for fatigue, and it gets really complicated. So we can't have the breastfeeding conversation without having the normal infant behavior conversation and the normal sleep conversation and the influences of others conversation, if that makes sense.
Yes, that does totally, because I do this myself. I know it's really bad. So you see a woman postnatally and she brings the baby and you're, I don't know, checking her cesarean wound or whatever it is. And as a kind of social, how are you? One of the questions you ask is, you know, how's the baby doing? Are you getting any sleep? And you're trying to do it as a caring thing. How are you doing? Making conversation. But actually, the expectation that the baby's suddenly going to sleep through the night and that it's not going to be this very disrupted pattern for quite a long time, that's a total social thing. That the one of the first questions you ask someone with a baby is, how are they sleeping?
Yeah. Or are they good? They're good.
Yes.
And of course, what we mean by that is, are they in a routine? Are they sleeping through the night? And of course, that harks back. I mean, we could talk about that all day, but yeah, that goes back at least 200 years, that the kind of the good baby, the good mother, the baby in a routine, the baby sleeping through the night, all of that is not actually new. It's not the fault of 1950s or 60s parenting. We actually need to go back to the Industrial Revolution to pin the blame of that kind of nonsense on anybody. So, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, I think medical intervention is wonderful. You know, I'm a big fan of medics. I'm married to one. My dad's a medic. I've got lots of medic friends. But I think medicine can be intrusive. We can over-medicalize things. We can over-pathologize things. And sadly, infant feeding and infant behavior was one of the victims of pathologization and medicalization of stuff that really should never have been medicalized in the first place. And, you know, way back when people in white coats decided that the really important work of feeding and growing and nurturing our babies shouldn't be left to kind of the wishy-washy territory of female intuition, that's when the rules about feeding started creeping in. And you know, things like you should feed them for 3 minutes on each side on the first day and 4 minutes on each side on the second day and 7 minutes on each side on the and no more than every 4 hours. Otherwise, that baby's going to be manipulative. And oh, my word, it just this stuff isn't new, but unfortunately, yeah. It's pervasive and it hasn't really gone away in a meaningful way because there's still people out there peddling this stuff, sadly.
Yes.
And then boring old farts like me come along and try and dispel it as often as we can, but it's really hard work. And again, that comes down to not everybody knows everything they need to know about infant feeding. There aren't enough people who know lots about infant feeding, and so there's very few of us who are shouting about this stuff. And when we do, we're sometimes branded lactivists when actually all we're trying to do is support people to meet their infant feeding goals. But there we go.
Yeah. Fantastic. So I feel like, well, this has just been a riveting conversation. I'm really enjoying it. But I'm wondering if we should end on that note. So I normally end with a zesty bit. So something that we're really hoping that people listening are going to take away from this episode. And that may be one thing for health professionals listening and one thing for women and families listening, or they might be the same thing.
Mm.
So I don't know what you feel. I mean, I've certainly taken away a lot from this, but what do you think would be a good zesty bit?
It's a great question. And you did warn me you were going to ask this. So I really have no excuse to not have something up my sleeve. Do you know what, though? I think, honestly, the one thing, and I think it takes experience to know this, but the most experienced people are not afraid of saying, I don't know. There's humility is a really lost art, I think. And I think the people I've always respected most throughout, you know, whatever learning I've been doing or however much I've studied, it's been when people have said, gosh, you know, that's a great question. I've actually got no idea. Let me go away. I'm going to look that up. I'm going to ask some people I trust. Can I come back to you? And honestly, just I have so much respect when people do that. So know what you don't know. If you don't know what you don't know, then the first step is to figure out what you don't know. And then I think for parents, I say this all the time, but don't be afraid to be the expert on your own baby. You parents are the experts on their own children. Inherently, that they know them. And I think, unfortunately, the last couple of hundred years have eroded that confidence that we are the experts on our children. Because when people are giving out information about strict routines and following the rules and doing X, Y, and Z, what happens when you do that is that deviates from instinct and that kind of deep gut feeling, because actually it requires you to ignore your gut feeling and listen to what the book is saying or listen to what the expert is saying or that person on Instagram with a million followers is saying. And when we start deviating from our instinct, that's when we're lost. We keep needing to go back to the experts to get the answer, when actually the answer is probably in our gut in the first place. So kind of learning to lean into that instinct, I think, is a really important piece. Certainly as a parent, as a professional, as a, you know, parent of children who have had major health challenges, it's been really important to me to lean into that instinct. But then also in my professional work, I've seen time and time again how when parents have the confidence to go, do you know, there's just something not quite right. I'm not happy about this. I'm going to trust my gut and I'm going to go to A&E with this really weird nebulous symptom that feels odd to describe, but I've just got this sense that something's not quite right. It's usually right. Parents have good instincts.
I think that's very wise. I remember when my eldest daughter was massively cluster feeding when she was a few weeks old, and I was getting more and more stressed. I couldn't put her down. She just would feed and feed and feed and feed. And my NCT teacher said, just stop fighting it. Just sit on the sofa, sit with her, feed her nonstop if that's what she wants. listen to some music, watch some TV, even have a glass of wine if you want. Just stop fighting it. And actually, that was right, the right thing, the right advice.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And it was because I had all these other, like you say, expectations and thoughts about this is a bad thing, I'm encouraging her to do whatever, that actually that was what was distressing me, not actually my baby.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the catastrophizing. If I don't knock this on the head, it's going to go on forever. I'm never going to get, you know, my boob back in my bra ever again. It's going to be out for the rest of my days. And, you know, in our kind of sleep deprived, hazy, not quite thinking straight brains, we end up just doing lots of thinking that isn't always helpful. Again, that's where instinct has to be coupled with some of that, you know, social mirroring and social support, because sometimes we do need someone to go, do you know what? It's a pain in the bum, but you're doing fine. Your baby's completely normal. Just keep going. In a few days, it'll probably be all over and you'll be onto a new annoying problem. And that's just life. But,
yeah,
you know, why don't we have a cup of tea and have a moan about it and it'll be fine. Yeah.
Lovely.
That's too many tips. That's not two tips. But anyway, hopefully there's something in there.
No, I think those are great tips. I think the instinctive thing, and also don't be afraid to say you don't know. I definitely say I don't know quite a lot.
I think it comes with experience, because I think the problem is when you're inexperienced in your job, you worry that you're going to appear to be unknowledgeable and a bit inept and a bit incompetent. It actually takes quite a significant amount of experience to know that actually people don't think that when you say you don't know. They have lots of respect for it. So kind of get on that train early. If you yes. are still early in your career, just, you know, don't wait 20 years to say, oh geez, I don't know. Start saying it now.
Particularly as, like, when we look at things like the CQC maternity survey and friends and family feedback and so on, the thing people complain about in relation to feeding is inconsistent advice, different people coming and telling them to do something different. So at least if you're saying, I don't know, and going and checking the facts or asking someone who does, you're not then giving potentially inconsistent and wrong advice. So actually, you may think you're being ignorant and displaying your ignorance, but actually what you're doing is not making a situation that's a problem worse.
Absolutely. Yeah. My recent study of parents breastfeeding in the pediatric setting, so slightly different setting, but a lot of the issues obviously are relevant. One of the things they said was actually people being kind glossed over a lot of the other stuff. So if you're just kind and encouraging and supportive, even if you don't know the answer, that's actually a really good place to start. So start with that and then go and find out where to get the rest of the information from. Because yes, people get frustrated when you can't answer their problem, but what they find more frustrating is when you make stuff up, when you say the wrong thing, when you contradict someone that they've already spoken to about that before. That's when the hackles start going up, and that's when you're going to start getting pals complaints, because people hate any hint of blagging or BS. They focus on it, and it can mar an entirely positive experience just through one negative little element. So yes,
thank
definitely.
You.
Definitely.
I feel like we could talk all
day. We probably could, but we'd probably better not.
Yes, exactly. So I think we'll stop there. But it's been absolutely lovely to reconnect and to talk to you. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. And thank you for helping me out of a seriously sticky spot 10 years ago as well. That's hugely appreciated.
My pleasure. I very much hope you found this episode of the Obs Pod interesting. If you have, it'd be fantastic if you could subscribe, rate, and review on whatever platform you find your podcasts, as well as recommending
the ObsPod to anyone you think might find it interesting. There's also tons of episodes to explore in my back catalogue, from clinical topics, my career and journey as an obstetrician, and life in the NHS more generally. I'd like to assure women I care for that I take confidentiality very seriously and take great care not to use any patient identifiable information unless I have expressly asked the permission of the person involved on that rare occasion when it's been absolutely necessary. If you found this episode interesting and want to explore the subject a little more deeply, don't forget to take a look at the programme notes where I've attached some links. If you want to get in touch to suggest topics for future episodes, you can find me at the ObsPod on Twitter and Instagram, and you can email me theobspod@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.